Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, September the 7th, 1995. In the fireside room this morning, our speaker is Ron Burke. His subject, The Lighter Side of Faith. Don't let anybody get your goat. Let's listen in.
My name is Ron Burke. This is the fourth and final in the series, The Lighter Side of Faith. And the title of today's presentation is Don't Let Anybody Get Your Goat. On the bulletin board, if you noticed, they misspelled it and said, Don't Let Antibody Get Your Goat. I guess there's some medical message in that which I didn't get. But anyway, we're going to talk. Well, I'm not going to tell you what we're going to talk about. I'm just going to talk about it. But again, if you have been in my sessions, you know that we know that it takes a while to get the goats here. So we will do a few things that will eventually tie in, I think. It has been mentioned throughout the week by me, that I am involved in the ranching business, and that one of the things that makes my ranching endeavor a little bit unique from a lot of other ranchers around the country is that we raise goats, Angora goats, and a lot of you have talked to me about goats. In fact, more of you have talked to me about goats than have God. But that's all right, because I probably know more about goats than I know about God. And I don't know a whole lot about goats. I have prepared a very scholarly paper on goats that probably from the interest shown by some of you, I owe it to you to share this with you this morning, so bear with me. In the world of domestic animals, goats are not considered glamorous. Horses, cattle, sheep, even pigs all seem to rank high above goats in popular polls. Horses have been the darlings of the affluent for centuries. Cattle are the current in pop art subject. Herds of stuffed sheep grace the shelves of toy and gift stores. Pigs are among the hottest new household pets. But goats? I think it's time to put in a plug for these forgotten animals. The number two source of milk consumed in the entire world is from goats. Number one, human milk, and number three is cow's milk. Number two is goat's milk. Isn't that amazing? Aren't you glad you came and learned about that? No, most third world countries around the world cannot support a cow. So, but if you go into those little villages, there will be milk goats running all over the place. So that's where that comes from. That statistic emphasizes the universality of goats. They're found all over the globe in all countries. They can survive on the meagerest of rations, much less than a cow. Goats provide not only milk, but also meat, fiber, leather, and companionship. As a result, goats have been an integral part of many societies for thousands of years. And scientists are discovering this influence as they find out more about the original spelling of the names of historical people and places. Are there any seats left? There's one right there that I didn't train people well enough to. There is a balcony, by the way. There are two seats in the balcony?
Lots of floor seats.
Lots of floor. Okay. We are in the middle of a scholarly dissertation on goats, and you missed the scholarly part. But repeat the sentence I just said. Scholars are discovering this influence of goats around the world as they find out more about the original spelling of the names of historical people and places. For example, some religious researchers believe the familiar "baa" cry of the goat is reflected in the name of the heathen god Baal. This leads them to theorize that other biblical names may have had the same roots. Bathsheba, Barabbas, and John the Baptist being possibilities. Maybe even the power of Babel. Secular historians have the same theory about the Spanish explorer Balboa, the French writer Balzac, and even the famed German composer J.S. Bach. All of these people may have had goat herders among their ancestry. More obvious historical connections to goats are reflected in many names whose present spelling has been only slightly altered from the original. For example, the Philistine giant Goliath and the goat Samaritan being two examples from the Bible. Along with such holy places as the land of Goshen, the Garden of Gethsemane, and the hill called Golgotha. And then one of the most famous personages in all of the Bible is Joseph and his goat of many colors. For those on the tape, you just missed a visual aid. Religious history also contains many such names. There is Johannes Gutenberg, who first printed the Bible, and the Swedish reformer Gustavus Adolphus, being a couple who come to mind. And we shouldn't overlook the great Gothic cathedrals in Germany with their magnificent bas-reliefs. They also have flying buttresses, which are winged nanny goats, in case you don't know about that. Who's that? Thank you, God, at least one. Other names that hint at their previous goatly connection, we have Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, here in the United States. We have San Francisco's Golden Goat Bridge. And in Texas, we have the Guadalupe River. That's for the Texans. Then we have some famous people in history, the German poet Goethe, the Dutch painter Vincent van Gogh, and the American tire mogul Charles Goodyear. And from legend and lore, we have the famous bareback rider Lady Godiva, along with the other little girl in the fairy tale named for her long golden mohair, Goldilocks. So you can see the influence of goats upon people and places is much greater than most of us realize, and to increase that awareness, it would greatly help if you would share this information you have received here this morning with anyone that you know, and as continued research discovers more about such goat-given names, we will pass them on to you. So there's your scholarly dissertation on goats this morning. Well, sometimes it goes over. Well, enough of that. This morning, I would like to kind of base what I say on the 55th Psalm, the first 8 verses of it, and this is the Good News Bible translation. Hear my prayer, O God, don't turn away from my plea. Listen to me and answer me. I am worn out by my worries. I am terrified by the threats of my enemies, crushed by the oppression of the wicked. They bring trouble on me. They are angry with me and hate me. I am terrified, and the terrors of death crush me. I am gripped by fear and trembling. I am overcome with horror. I wish I had wings like a dove. I would fly away and find rest. I would fly far away and make my home in the desert. I would hurry and find myself a shelter from the raging wind and the storm. And the bell. Those of you who have been sitting in on the Bible study heard Bill say the other day that one of his, or somewhere, maybe it was in his Vesper service, that he said that one of his favorite books of the Bible sections is the Psalms, and I am the same way. If people were asking me what my favorite part of the Bible is, it'd be very easy. It is the book of Psalms. And the main reason I like Psalms is because I can personally identify with these heartfelt expressions of inner emotions. It seems as if no matter what emotion I am feeling at a particular time, whether I'm at the heights of ecstasy and joy or in the pits of depression or despair or anywhere in between, all I have to do is open up these poetic pages and the biblical bard is expressing almost exactly the same emotions that I am feeling. For example, that psalm that I just read in the second verse of the 55th Psalm, I can really identify with, and that is, I am worn out by my worries. Just discovered that translation not long ago. Love it. I'm worn out by my worries. As I have shared with some of you that have been in these sessions before, I have had sort of a lifelong struggle with stress and tension. On various occasions, I've had everything from tension headaches to digestive problems. I mentioned my hypoglycemia, and I guess we've sat with each other long enough that I can say that I have had enough bouts with hemorrhoids that I've learned how to spell it. We can have a little test this morning and see who could spell hemorrhoids. My wife isn't here, so I can do that. She doesn't like it when I use it. All of these physical ailments almost always have been as a result of some sort of stress and tension or worry in my life. They have been physical manifestations of some sort of emotional feeling inside of me. And I don't think that I'm alone. If we were of the testifying type of Christians and allowed you to get up and tell your tales this morning, I'm sure that many, if not all of you, could share the scars that you have as a result of your struggles with stress. Talked a little bit about the fact that stress is such a problem in our society. Prevention Magazine back, I think it was in the March issue, had the results of a survey of like 11,000 people that on some of their major problems, and stress was number one. As they said, if we had a machine, a cuff big enough, and were to put it on the arm of the Statue of Liberty to check her blood pressure, it would probably be very high. Those who know say that 75%, some even say higher, of all doctor visits are stress-related. That's for younger people. Us older people have true ailments, right? But 75% of hospital visits, or not hospital, doctor visits, are said to be stress-related, and I see no reason to argue with that. As I say, it could be even higher. So it's quite obvious, I think, that stress is a problem in our society. But if you stop and think about it, it's probably nothing new. Nothing new at all. The problems of stress have probably been around from the very, very beginning. I just imagine that old Eve had a few digestive problems after eating of the forbidden fruit. And a number of other biblical characters found themselves in similar situations. Just think of the pressure that old Noah must have felt trying to get all those animals on the ark before it started to rain. About as bad as trying to get all the Iowans on the bus before it's time to leave. Or how about the tense muscles and the sweaty palms that little David must have felt as he walked out on that Palestinian plain to face his big old giant Goliath, and all he had in his hand was a little bitty slingshot. Or what about the knot that surely appeared in the stomach of Peter on that cool, crisp Jerusalem morning when he heard the rooster crow and realized that Jesus' prediction had come true. He had denied that he knew his master and friend. And speaking of Jesus, if Jesus is truly as human as we teach and believe, equally human, equally God, is a basic Christian teaching. If he is that human, then he too was probably not immune from the stresses and scars and struggles of stress. Just think back to that night before he was crucified in the Garden of Gethsemane, where Mark writes, distress and anguish came over him, and he said to his disciples, "The sorrow in my heart is so great that it almost crushes me." And Luke adds to the picture of tension when he writes, "In great anguish he prayed even more fervently. His sweat was like drops of blood falling to the ground." Now, folks, that is a picture of a person under pressure. So stress and tension, worry and pressure, they're nothing new. Our biblical predecessors felt them then just as much, if not more so, than you and I do now. And I find it interesting that those biblical characters' reaction in the face of stress is almost exactly the same as mine, and that is the great burning desire to escape it. Jesus prayed, "Father, if you will, take this cup of suffering away from me." And the psalmist cries out longingly, "I wish I had wings like a dove. I would fly away and find rest. I would fly far away and make my home in Holden Village, in the desert. I would hurry and find myself a shelter from the raging wind and the storm." Now, I understand that desire to flee the terrors of tension. Not only do I understand it, but quite frankly, I practice it. The way that I have managed to survive the stressful times in my life over the years is to practice the philosophy of Linus in the comic strip Peanuts, and that is that no problem is so big or so great that you can't run away from it. Yes, quite regularly I run away. Not permanently, but at least for a little while, just long enough to get my batteries charged so that I can get enough strength to return to the fray. And as I have mentioned, the place that I most often run away to is that family ranch, which through the gift of inheritance is mine in the Texas Hill Country. I've talked to you about it almost every time we've gotten together, and I guess that'll give you some idea of how important that place is to me. It is a place where I run away to rest, relax, and recuperate from the stress-filled world in which I live so much of my time. In fact, if I had not had that place over the years, I probably would not have made it physically, mentally, emotionally, or spiritually. And one of the very special things about that place is the fact that we raise goats, as also you've heard me talk about. And I really do love goats. They've been not very good money makers the last few years, and they've been, but the coyotes have thoroughly enjoyed them. And I do. I just like to work with goats. I like cattle, but I really love goats, I guess would be the only proper way to put it. As a result, I've become very interested in goats and goat lore, some of that I shared at the beginning. All of us have heard the old phrase, "Don't let anybody get your goat," haven't you? You've probably heard that at one time or another. I don't think that's limited to Texas. You may not know the source of that old saying. It comes from the world of horse racing. If you know anything about racehorses, you know they tend to be tense, high-strung animals. And from the very beginning of the sport, trainers were trying to figure out some way that they could calm these racehorses down, get them to conserve their energy for the right time in the right place out on the track during the race. Well, sometime, somewhere, someone, somehow discovered that if you would take a goat, yes, a goat, and put it in the stall with that racehorse, it would have an amazingly calming effect upon the horse. In fact, even today, if you're around racetracks or even rodeos, sometimes you will see a lot of goats running around. You might wonder about that. That is one of the main reasons they're there, that a lot of these racehorses bond with these goats, and they're their friends, and they calm them down. However, we human beings, being the devious animals that we are, someone also discovered that if you would sneak into your opponent's stall the night before the race and steal their goat, that would really upset the horse. They'd pace all night, use up all their energy, and be an easy opponent out on the racetrack the next day. And that is the source of the old saying, "Don't let anybody get your goat." Now, wasn't that worth traveling all across? Where else but Holden Village would you learn something like that? Well, I like that old saying mainly because my goats very literally have had a calming effect upon me. They have helped me survive the rat race of life. Now, I'm not saying that you got to go out and buy a bunch of goats or get a ranch if you don't already have some, although if you'd like to buy some goats, I know where you can get some pretty cheap. Right there. I guess what I am saying is that all of us need diversions. Diversions from the tensions of everyday life, something that will put our minds and bodies and souls at rest. Ford Motor Company, for a good many years now, has been using the slogan, "The best never rest." And I understand what they're trying to get across in those commercials. But I think a better slogan for most of us would be the best better rest. As Robert Orban has wisely observed, the problem with living life in the fast lane is you get to the toll booth faster. Which ties into Stephen Wright's observation, I think God is going to come down and pull civilization over for speeding. And again, this is nothing new. It's one that even Jesus himself experienced. Remember that scene in Mark 6 where we read there were so many people coming and going that Jesus and his disciples didn't even have time to eat. Sounds like a scene from contemporary family life, doesn't it? So he said to them, let us go off by ourselves to some place where we can be alone and you can rest a while. So they started out in a boat by themselves to a lonely place. I think we can see from this passage that Jesus realized himself the need to get away and to rest. In fact, we also get a hint here that Jesus may have even had his own diversions. A writer by the name of Kimberly Bobo makes this provocative suggestion. Have you ever noticed in reading the Gospels that Christ was regularly found riding in boats? Now, no doubt boats were a major means of transportation in those days. However, says Bobo, I believe Jesus enjoyed riding in boats. Remember the time he slept through a violent storm? Boy, you really got to enjoy boats to be able to sleep during a storm. So Jesus knew the importance of diversion and rest and facing the storms of life, and he didn't let anybody get his goat. One other thing I think that is noteworthy about Jesus and his attitude toward getting away is that I'm regularly kind of surprised when I reread the Gospels, you know, that we all think of Jesus as a very public person, and that he was, you know. He would preach to the multitude, feed the 5,000, heal the masses. But if you read those Gospels, there are several instances where after he has done something very public like that, almost literally the next verse will say, and from there he went away by himself to a lonely place to pray. Jesus was a very public person, but he was also a very private person. And I think that's very important for us to remember, that it was in those private times that he plugged into his Father, he got the wisdom, the strength, the energy to go back and be the public person that he was called to be. He was only able to be the public person that he was because he was the private person that he was. And that's very important for me to know. I'm a very public person. I've been very public here the last few days doing this kind of thing. As I go around and as you become more familiar with me, people are constantly talking to me. That's great. I love that. But I'm also a very private person. Raised on a ranch, I guess that was somewhat natural, but I just glory in being alone by myself. And it took me a long time to kind of, ease my guilt that, hey, I shouldn't like to be alone. I'm a public person. I should be with people all the time. Finally, I really got this message of Jesus as a role model, that I can only be a public person as I am a private person. I need those quiet times of silence and solitude away. Again, not just to get physical rest, that is so important, we talked about that yesterday, but also just to get the mental rest and also to plug in through prayer and listening so that I can have something to say when I go back into my public realm. And I think that relates to all of us. We are public people to varying degrees, but all of us are public people. We all live our lives, as I mentioned the other night, in a world of other people. That may just be your family, or it may be your work, your church, wherever. But you spend a lot of your time with other people as a public person. And that's very important, very, very important. But it's also very draining sometimes. And it's okay to have those private times of silence and solitude alone so that you can re-energize your mind, body, and soul and go back and be the public person with those other people. So Jesus is a good role model here. All of us are public people, but we need to be private people so that we can be the public person we are called to be. Also, I find it interesting that not only did Jesus go off by himself on several occasions to pray and be alone, but also, like this Mark 6 passage, he goes off with a small group of his disciples. Several occasions like that. And I think those too are important little message containers for those of us today. Because not only did Jesus realize that those disciples needed some physical rest, and if you really look at the gospel, it was a horrendous schedule that those people were following during the height of Jesus' ministry. It just must have been greatly physically draining, always on the go and having to find food for these people and so forth and so on. And Jesus, in his wisdom, said, hey, you guys, you need a day off, so let's go off and rest. So that was important. But it was also important on another realm, and that was the fact that it was in these occasions when Jesus went off with just a small group of people that those people not only were physically refreshed, but they suddenly begin to get a whole new insight into some things. For example, undoubtedly they saw Jesus in a totally different way in those small group situations than they did when he was in a public situation. They were able to be much more intimate with him, to talk with him, to listen to him, to really begin to know who he was and what he was about. Also, it was in those occasions that they began, I think, to understand each other a little bit better. That also when they were out in this public life, they were so busy doing their stuff, they didn't really have a chance to get to know each other and understand each other. But in those small times, with all these distractions, they could see who their brothers in that particular instance were, begin to understand them, see who they were as a team, how they fit together. And thirdly, they probably began to see themselves in a new light, to see where they fit in on this team of disciples, where their particular gifts and talents could be used, what Jesus' mission was and how they fit in, and also how they personally related to Jesus. I just imagine there were a lot of great personal insights gained in those times away with small groups. And I think that is very important for us to remember in this day and age. For many years, have been a strong proponent of retreating in the church. Retreating in the traditional Christian sense of that word, of getting away so that you can get back to it all. Getting away from it all so you can get back to it all. The kind of model that we've just been talking about. The last 3.5 years, I've been kind of involved in that more directly as a part of my ministry in Texas, going out and leading retreats and promoting retreats and saying a lot of the things that I'm saying this morning to the people of Texas, trying to make us aware that we need personal retreats, getaway. We also need retreats with our family of faith. You are doing that right now, whether you realize it or not. Some of you are here with groups, the group from Texas, the group from based in Iowa, and you're here at Holden Village, which has as one of its prime reasons for being as a retreat place, a place to fly away. And I hope when you leave here, or maybe while you're still here, if you will really stop and kind of objectively analyze what has happened to you in this experience. I've been here, I think I was figuring out this is my sixth. In the last 3 years, I've been here as a leader, in a loose sense of that word, of groups from Texas. And it's been very interesting to me to observe what happens to people. Just some really deeply spiritual things have happened to people here. And a lot of times they weren't really aware that they were happening to them until they kind of got back and got that perspective to see what was really happening. Groups are bonded together in an experience like this that no other way can bond them together. It'll be great if once I came up here with a group from our congregation, about 20 just from our congregation, and our congregation was different when we went back home because those people were so much closer together, trusted each other. I believe very strongly in church council retreats with no agenda except to get to know each other. Because so much of the time that is wasted and so much of the conflict that goes on in church business quite frequently occurs because people don't know each other, they don't trust each other. And if you can go off and just play for a day or two or a weekend, and suddenly all those barriers are broken down, which we've talked about in the past, that group begins to trust each other, know each other, and when they have a church council meeting, they go in, and when Joe over here says, I move this, there's not a bunch of people sitting there now, I wonder what his hidden agenda really is, and so forth and so on. They know Joe or Mary, and they say, okay, you know, or they can disagree, whatever. But it saves a lot of time, it saves a lot of conflict. I highly recommend retreats for church councils and for churches, just for all the things that I've said, and for individuals. I don't know that I need to say a whole lot more about the value of a retreat for an individual, but it is a time of refreshment. There's no question about it. No question about it. So, don't let anybody get your goat. Find time in your life for moments of silence, solitude, times to get away, to be with yourself, your fellow members of the family of faith, and with your God. It will be time well spent. It will be time where you don't let anybody get your goat. What I would like to do for the next few moments is to, well, have a little lab work, for lack of a better term. Some of you have undoubtedly gone through some relaxation exercises. Doesn't necessarily have to be in the church setting, but in case some of you have not, I would like to kind of expose you to this. It is something that I find very valuable for myself, and something you can take home with you. And even if you know how to do it, you don't often get the opportunity to do it in a group. So we're going to do that today. What I'd like to do is, first of all, if you're going to rest the soul, you have to rest its container, the temple of the soul. The body and the soul are so intimately connected that sometimes it is obvious all the time, but we're not always aware of that. So if you're having soul problems, you might want to start with your body and see what's happening. So we're going to make sure you relax your body. First of all, I would like for you to sit in your chairs as erectly as possible with both feet on the floor and your back. Take all the stuff out of your lap and bags off your shoulders, burdens off wherever. You can leave your fanny packs on. It's amazing how many things y'all people have. All of us, you know, I'm a sloucher. I love to get it in all kinds of positions. But really, when you're sitting, one of the best ways is to sit one of the most comfortable ways is to sit the way you're supposedly sitting now, with erect and your feet on your floor. Both feet on the floor, and you just kind of put your hands in your lap loosely. breathing, as we've mentioned again in some of the sessions here, is very important to life. I think that's obvious. So, but the main thing you want to do in the act of breathing is to get as much good air and the oxygen and all the good stuff into your body as possible, and then once that's been used up and converted, you want to get all that bad stuff out. That is the whole ultimate goal of any breathing, is to get as much good air in and as much bad air out. And there is a proper way to breathe. I want you to put your hand on your tummy. Has everybody found it? And inhale, take a deep breath. And exhale. Now, if your hand went up when you inhaled and went down when you exhaled, you were breathing properly. Check it out. Think of the lungs, the diaphragm, as a balloon or a bottle, whichever one you want. And what you're trying to do in the act of breathing is to fill that up. And then when you exhale, you're emptying it. And if you've had any singing training or musical instrument training, supposedly you've been taught to breathe properly. But I have a tendency every once in a while, somebody says, take a deep breath and go, well, that ain't right, folks. It's to just fill that up and then empty it out. Deep breathing can be, well, let's just do this for a moment. Let's try to get at this in a little rhythm now. You can put your hands down. You don't have to. Just kind of put your hands open with palms up in your lap if you can. Let's breathe in and out for a moment. Kind of see if we can all get in rhythm. I'll count. Okay, ready? One, two, three.
No.
Now, Coach, you used to tell me, he used to be my football coach, he said, okay, one, two, three, and I tell him. First time in my life I've ever said you to do this. You won't even. I'm sorry, I'm causing tension in it.
I'll let him get your goat.
Okay, inhale. One, two, three, four, exhale, one, two, three, four, inhale, one, two, four, exhale. Now you can probably already begin to feel some of the physical effects of that. It's a good thing to remember anytime you get in a tense situation. One of the first things they teach us as public speakers, if you get butterflies before you go up to speak, take a deep breath. And it's amazing how relaxing it can be. I'd like for you now to close your eyes. You can trust me, I'm not sure about the person sitting next to you. And if you have contacts, you may just want to pick a point on the wall or something. The idea is to cut out all distractions as much, but just kind of close your eyes and keep kind of concentrating on your breathing, try to get in some sort of a rhythm. What I'm going to do now is go through a little relaxation exercise to relax your body. I'm going to take you through your body and mention a part of your body and just concentrate on that particular part of your body and relax it. For example, relax your toes. Relax your feet. Relax your ankles. Relax your calves. And your knees. Relax your thighs. Relax your perhaps your buttocks. Relax your lower back. Relax your tummy. Relax your chest. Relax your fingers. And your lower arm, forearms. Your elbows. Your upper arms. Now we're getting up that area which is the seat of tension for so many people, your shoulders. Relax your shoulders. And your neck. Kind of relax your jaw, make sure your teeth are not gritted, kind of just relax your jaw. Relax your cheeks. And your nose. And your eyes. Relax your ears. Your forehead. Relax your scalp. Just relax. Now I'd like to take you on a little guided trip through this magic mind that we all have. In your mind, imagine yourself on the shore of a lake. On the shore of a lake. Visualize that in your mind. There's a boat pulled up to the shore of the lake. A bunch of men gathered around it. You walk down to it, and they greet you and invite you to get on the boat with them. They're getting ready to go across this lake. And you go with them. And you find out that it's Jesus and his disciples. They're getting ready to go across the lake, the Sea of Galilee. And you're going with them. The boat pushes off, starts out across the lake. Again, what do you see as you are on that boat, on that lake? What do you see? The lake, the clouds, the sky, the boat, the people. What do you see? What do you hear? What are the sounds? The splashing of the water against the side of the boat, the flapping sails. What do you hear? What do you feel? The sun on your skin, maybe some spray from the water. What are some of the things you feel on this boat, on this lake? Are there things you can taste? Maybe a little sweat on your upper lip. Are there things you can taste? Suddenly, as you are sailing calmly across this lake, a storm comes up very quickly as they can in this part of the country. There's clouds, there's wind, there's lightning, there's thunder, and suddenly the water begins to boil and the boat is tossed about. Experience that storm. And in the middle of the storm, the disciples go up to Jesus, who is in the front of the boat, sleeping, and they say, "Wake up, teacher. Don't you care that we're about to die?" And Jesus wakes up, stands up, looks at the storm, the wind, and the waves, and he says, "Be quiet. Be still." And lo and behold, the storm listens to him. The storm stops. The winds are calmed. Experience that calm after the storm. And now think of some storm in your life right now. It could be physical, mental, emotional, relational, spiritual. Think of some storm that's going on in your life right now. And now, listen as Jesus says to the storm in your life, "Be quiet. Be still. And the storm in your life obeys. It is calmed. It is stilled." Experience the calm after the storm. At your leisure and your own pace, you may come back to this time and place. I forgot to mention, if you go to sleep during that experience, that's fine. Your body is telling you something.
I started to fall off the boat. So rough.
You started to fall off the boat. How many of you had, first of all, just done a relaxation exercise like this before? Quite a few. Had you ever done, this was, the last part of this was what we call a guided meditation. How many of you had done something like that? Not as many of you. Okay. Were you, how many of you were able to, well, first of all, able to relax? Okay. That is as I say, nothing particular Christian or religious or anything else about that. I just noticed this morning there was a book in the bookstore called The Relaxation Response. A lot of therapists and people are using that. And it's just an excellent way, anytime you find yourself in a tense situation, to do that kind of thing, and you can kind of calm yourself down. I find it an excellent way if I'm having a little trouble sleeping or something at night, just to kind of do that. And there are variations on how you can do this, but that is exposing you to one way to relax your body. The second guided imagery, as a lot of people call it, is also used quite a bit in all kinds of ways. I use this kind of guided meditation quite frequently because I just think it has a lot of possibilities. How many were able to get into that? Were you able to see the scene?
The fish.
Pardon me?
I got a few fish in
there. You caught some fish?
I walked 10 miles together.
You can do better in your imagery. Okay, sometimes people are really able to get into this and experience all these senses. Sometimes you're not. If you weren't this time, don't give up on this. This is your first exposure to it, because we're just at different places at different times. And if you had a good experience this time, next time you may have not. But I just say that because don't judge this kind of thing on one experience, because our bodies and physical settings, and there was some voices in the background that can be distracting and so forth. But it is amazing sometimes how well people can get into these things. I've had some people get almost seasick in the storm and get frightened.
Your muscles actually tense up a bit in the storm.
You did?
Uh-huh.
Okay, that was the idea. Yeah. If you really got a little like this with the storm, then you're really into that. Some of you have some experiences with this that you'd like to share, either with any of the senses or...
I had one relaxation scale thing we used in the hospital.
Talking about this one we just had.
Oh, no.
Were you able to see and feel and all that?
Yeah. Okay. But in order to relax more, you first tense that very thing and then relax.
Yeah, that's another variation on the original, right? Just tense that muscle and then relax it. Yeah. Connie?
I had some people I have struggled with their picture came through that whole scene. When people are struggling with, different areas, and they're, I got an image of that they're facing during this time.
Okay. Well, we're kind of getting down to the end of our time here, and a lot of distractions outside. But I hope, if this is the first time you've had this kind of experience, that maybe it won't be your last. Whether you realize it or not, you just had a Bible study. It's a very familiar passage in Mark, the calming of the storm. Most of us, especially in the Lutheran Church, when we think of Bible studies, we think of sitting down and really doing a head thing, a scholarly thing. Let's find out what the Greek root of these words were and so forth and so on. And that's fine and good, but you have to remember that most of the people who were the original hearers of the gospel and readers were illiterate people. They got most of their information orally. And you had to be a pretty good speaker to get across to these people. And you also had to be a pretty good actor. By that I mean somebody who did things. And Jesus did as many things as he said, if not more, And we have in the Gospels not only all these fine theological dissertations, but we also have scenes like this one right here. Now, how do we find the truth in that particular scene? Well, I feel that one way to do that is to try to really identify with the people who were in the middle of that experience. And what did that mean to them on an emotional level? Because we are not always communicated truth rationally. A lot of it comes through emotion. And if I can really understand what it means to be out in the middle of a lake, in the middle of a storm, and all the fear and tension that goes with that, I can identify with those people. And when that storm is calmed and I can feel that, then I begin to understand what that experience meant to those people and what truth Jesus was trying to communicate to them. This is an excellent way, as I say, to do Bible study, I think. Not every passage in Scripture relates to this, but just try that sometimes on some of the scenes, the old familiar scenes. Sit down and try to do this, get relaxed, and put yourself in the scene. whatever it may be, calming of the storm. If you want to go back into the Old Testament, what would it be like to roam 40 years in the wilderness, or to fight a giant, or whatever? Imagery is a big thing nowadays psychologically, and it's amazing what our mind can do and where we can go. Talk about virtual reality. The mind is amazing. And we can learn a lot of theological, spiritual truths through our mind. Well, I hope we've planted some seeds here today. And I hope that you will look for times of silence and solitude. I just kind of realized that maybe some of you have too much silence and solitude in your lives. And get lonely. There's a world of difference between being alone and lonely. Somebody once said, God created the word lonely to show the fear and terror of solitude. He created the world alone to show the glories of solitude. There are times when all of us would give anything to be alone, away from the kids, grandkids, and everybody. But there is that terror sometimes of being lonely. If some of you are lonely, I hope maybe we've said some things here today that can help you change that into the joy of being alone and the possibilities of being alone. All of this, I hope, just helps so that you don't let anybody get you goat. Thank you very much for a...